Welcome to Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. I'm Melody Edwards. This time on the show, the month of Ramadan is a time for Muslims around the world to gather and pray and help the people around them. Usually international students travel home.
Well, due to COVID-19 right now, that didn't happen, so my trip was canceled.
Yellowstone National Park gateway communities are using a unique, if smelly, way to help monitor COVID-19 as tourists start to come back by testing the community's poop.
If you're seeing increased amounts of the virus in your wastewater, it may be an early indication that there are increasing cases in the community.
Those and more right here on Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. I'm Melody Edwards. While many businesses are losing money in the state, so are some Wyoming agencies. One that's getting the hardest hit is the Wyoming Department of Transportation. Wyoming Public Radio's Catherine Wheeler explains.
This is the time of year when lots of drivers are typically on Wyoming highways. But like in so many other ways, this spring has been far from usual.
What we're starting to see is a dramatic drop-off of miles traveled on the state.
That's Wyoming Department of Transportation Director Luke Reiner. He says across the state, automobile traffic is down about 25%, and truck traffic is down about 10%. And while that may be a good sign of people staying home, social distancing, and following state and local restrictions, it doesn't necessarily bode well for YDOT.
All of that affects our source of revenue, which is fuel tax. Fuel taxes is what primarily funds YDOT. We get zero general fund dollars, so we watch that very close.
YDOT does get some funding from mineral royalties, but it still mostly has to rely on money spent on fuel. And with this sudden drop-off, it could have major effects on the department's budget.
If the trend continues in the way it is, we could probably be in the $15 million-ish range between now and the end of September.
That's $15 million less because of the decline in fuel tax revenue, which would mean that YDOT may have to make some hard decisions about which projects may be delayed, or worse. YDOT is already an underfunded department. Reiner says before all this started, it's about $135 million short on just maintaining the state's highways. However, he says the 61 active construction projects and others slated for this year are safe for now.
One of the interesting things about Wyoming is that most of our projects on the highway are actually federally funded. And so in terms of the specific projects that we have going this year, don't anticipate any issues to those unless it's caused by a lack of material or crews getting really sick with COVID that could hurt our construction season.
But there's been one good piece of news from the federal government. Wyoming airports received close to $50 million in CARES Act funding through the U.S. Department of Transportation. Brian Olson is the Aeronautics Administrator for YDOT.
There is a rather complicated formula that was developed by the FAA to split out that money, and it looked at a variety of factors.
He says those factors include emplanements, the amount of debt an airport has, and unrestricted cash reserve levels. The amounts the Federal Aviation Administration is distributing range from $18 and $16 million at the Cody and Jackson Hole airports, respectively, to $20,000 or $30,000 at some of the smaller airports in the state.
They can use it for a variety of things such as payroll, operating expenses, maintenance expenses. It's really to help them hang on as we get through this unprecedented time and come out the other side and remain viable and strong.
Yellowstone Regional Airport Director Bob Hooper says the airport's board will decide what they do with the money, but they'll likely be using it for day-to-day expenses at the airport in Cody and some capital improvement projects.
Possibly putting in some navigational aids to help the airlines with landing operations during inclement weather, and also taking a look at the facilities in our current airport terminal building for improvements and expansion.
Hooper says while the amount of funding they received was a good surprise, they are anticipating major losses in travel this summer. And that feeling is mutual in other communities. Sheridan County Administrative Director Renee Obermuller says they were hoping its new service provider, SkyWest, would have a big impact.
We were above our totals in employments for January and February and even March compared back to dates as far back as we could go. So we were very encouraged about the new service, and then the COVID situation hit.
Obermuller says in April, they had about a 95% drop. Though she says things are starting to pick back up this month, they've reduced the number of flights a week during May to save some money. YDOT Director Luke Reiner says his department will be looking at options for saving money, but it's also looking into requesting some of the Federal CARES Act funding. But for now, he says he's proud of the way the department has responded during the pandemic, like continuing its construction projects, something not all states have done.
Our construction season is short. We thought that construction is really important to the economic vitality of the state, and we thought we could implement the correct protective measures for both YDOT employees and our contractors.
He says that drop in traffic has a silver lining after all. Crews have quicker turnaround times on construction projects, and the department is saving money on traffic control. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Catherine Wheeler.
Financial times are likely to trickle down. For instance, college students are exiting the University of Wyoming into an unknown job market. Normally, students would have jobs lined up, but these are not normal times. Joe Kitka is the UW's Director of Advising, Career, and Exploratory Studies. She joins Wyoming Public Radio's Bob Beck to discuss the situation.
How did life change? I imagine you were working with kids and lining up interviews, and then COVID-19 hits, and I imagine it's a little different world.
Absolutely. Luckily, we squeaked in our employer job fairs this spring, so we were able to get through our business and government job fair, our STEM job fair, and our teacher job fair before spring break, which was great. So that gave students the opportunity to interact with employers prior to taking that big pivot and sending everyone home. After that, we have a lot of online platforms that students have access to from wherever they're at. So that really helped. We sent out emails reassuring them that those were available, how to access them. We did see a downtick in the jobs that were posted to our Handshake site, which is where companies looking for new college graduates and summer interns post. So we saw a downtick for that in April, but it's picking back up, and actually there are more jobs being posted in May. So that's encouraging. We also surveyed all of the employers that did something on campus this year, be it attend a job fair or conduct student interviews, to see what their hiring plans were for students that had offers or for internships, and then to tentatively ask them what they may be thinking for next fall.
So what are they saying? Are they going to be hiring?
So it's obviously industry specific. The oil and gas industry is the sector that we've heard that they're very sad that they won't be hiring, and some of them either reneged on their offers to students that are graduating in May. A lot of companies have changed their internships to virtual internships. Some have shortened the length of the internship. And for students that had job offers, a lot of them indicated that they still plan on bringing them into the company, but they're just delaying their start date till everyone can get back to work.
What seems to be okay? What types of jobs are still out there and all right and probably going to continue to add?
Yeah, and I think that happens with any crisis. You know, some pop up that are really exploding. So obviously supply chain, anything with logistics, trying to get not just products to stores, but there's a lot of things that are, you know, being needed in our country right now. So that's one that's growing. The banking sector, especially with the federal relief efforts, banks are, you know, sorting through those small business loans, real estate with the interest rates lower. So banking is hiring. Any streaming service, everyone's obviously watching Netflix and Hulu. There's opportunities there. There's a lot of opportunity in instructional design, online learning platforms as K-12 and higher education moved into those modalities. So there's lots of opportunity there. We're seeing opportunity in construction, IT and software, and then retail, which is surprising, but companies like CVS and Walmart are looking, and Lowe's looking to hire people. So are all those jobs new college grad jobs? Not necessarily, but there are at least job opportunities out there.
Yeah, and that's interesting. You mentioned that there's that many. You mentioned energy, which I imagine is you know one big setback because we have a lot of students who want to go that direction. But when you said oil and gas, you didn't necessarily all energy. What about like wind and alternative energy, those kinds of things?
Yeah, we probably more so on the construction side of that. So there are still a lot of jobs with our construction management degree. We do have a presence with some of the wind energy companies, and we, unfortunately, none of them have responded to our survey at this point, but I would imagine that there still will be opportunity in that sector of the energy market.
You've always had a lot of people come here for College of Education graduates. What does that marketplace look like right now?
I was just looking at our job postings this morning. It's still strong, and we had a strong showing at our teacher fair back seems like 100 years ago, but it was early March. So that market still looks strong.
And I want to ask you this question, maybe with a little background. I mean, you've been through a lot of things. You've been there a long time. So we've seen 9/11. We've seen different things with the economy falling. We saw the Great Recession. How does this compare with some of that?
I think the difference, obviously, was the impact across a lot of different sectors and a lot of different industries and just how quickly it happened. Yes, with the Great Recession, there was an absolute impact in the financial market and the real estate market, which had the ripple effect, you know, affecting some other industries. But I think just everything halting for the most part and, you know, then people trying to figure out what work will look like going forward and, you know, as more employers sent people home, how will work be structured? And I think these are the big changes because with those other major events in our history, it was maybe a little bit, you could see the end of it perhaps, where this one we're not certain what the end looks like. But I do know what will change for certain is everyone will need to learn to do things virtually. So we're looking at virtual career fairs, virtual job interviews for our students because regardless of what our campus plan is in the fall, there are employers or states that may not allow travel, and so we just need to be quickly standing those opportunities up.
Joe Kitka, always a pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you, Bob.
After this, how the pandemic is affecting the University of Wyoming's Muslim community as they celebrate Ramadan. This is Open Spaces. Welcome back to Open Spaces. I'm Melody Edwards. It's usually around this time that Muslim international students would travel home to celebrate the rest of Ramadan together with their families. Ramadan is a significant holiday for Muslims around the world. But for these students, that's not happening this year due to COVID-19. Wyoming Public Radio's Nina Rao reports.
They are making like a ground beef stew.
That's Aisha Balaboon in her kitchen. She's cooking food to break her fast, also known as iftar. Aisha has been fasting for 3 weeks, observing Ramadan. It's a month where Muslims fast from dawn till dusk, and it's called the Holy Month because it's a time where people are encouraged to do good deeds, help each other, and have gratitude for their family and friends.
I'm gonna mix it up. I'm gonna let it cook some more.
Aisha is from Nigeria, and she was excited because her graduation coincided with the tail end of Ramadan. That meant Aisha was supposed to celebrate twice as much.
The plan was I was looking into flights for my mom and two brothers back home to also come here and spend graduation with me. And I was trying to time it in such a way like where they come here towards the end of Ramadan, you know, celebrate graduation with me and also celebrate Eid. That way we get to all celebrate it as a family.
But COVID-19 hit and none of that is happening.
COVID has affected a lot of travel plans, a lot of just, yeah, plans to spend time with, I guess, larger family, because I do have family here.
Instead of celebrating it with her extended family, Aisha is observing Eid with her two brothers and sister-in-law. And tonight, it's her turn to cook for dinner. Aisha and her siblings take turns to cook for iftar this month. So she's not really complaining because she's not alone facing this pandemic.
Yeah, it's definitely helped living with them, even especially of like, okay, you know, you have people to see on a day-to-day versus just living alone or just being alone with, you know, all that's going on in the world.
But Bilal Majur is spending this Ramadan alone. He's an international student from Algeria. And unlike Aisha, he doesn't have any family here. Bilal was supposed to fly back home once finals were over to spend the rest of Ramadan together with his family.
But due to COVID-19 right now, that didn't happen. So my trip was canceled and I had to stay here away from the family.
Ramadan doesn't always fall at the same time every year. It occurs on the ninth month in the Islamic calendar, which isn't the same as the Western calendar. Luckily, for the past few years, it's coincided with summer break, which is when Bilal usually goes back home anyway. So this is a big opportunity for him to not only catch up with his loved ones, but also celebrate Eid together.
In my personal, like, probably my family tradition, after, like, everybody is done with work or whatever they have during the day, we come together. I have a big family, so there is, like, groups of people cooking, people hanging out. Because we cook a lot of food and different stuff, so it takes some time. So whoever is helping in the kitchen does that right before the sunset. And the other group probably would be hanging around, watching stuff, or just, like, having fun together, waiting to break our fast.
And when it's time for iftar, which is when they break their fast at the end of the day, everybody comes together, sit at the dinner table, and eat way too much food.
Makes me miss it more right now.
To help keep his mind off of what he's missing, Bilal has been staying busy working and studying from home, and spending more time with his roommates, who are also observing Ramadan. Since Bilal is the president of the Muslim Student Association, he's able to help the Muslim community on campus plan ways to celebrate Ramadan together, especially when one of the goals of Ramadan is to help people in the community. Since they're not able to leave, they're helping in Laramie.
So we're looking into doing like a fastathon, and like every single person who fasts would pitch and donate into a cause that we're going to look for here in Laramie in the community. So they donate their money that they saved from eating lunch or breakfast.
Bilal has this idea to help some of these students who don't have a car or are too busy to get food for iftar. And he's trying to organize a delivery service like DoorDash, except it's run by volunteers from the community who's willing to cook and send food packages to the Muslim community in town. Bilal admits that he's a little bit nervous organizing such an elaborate initiative during a pandemic.
Do you feel hopeful, though?
Yes, definitely, 100%. I feel like it is going to be really good and people would like it and participate in it. In these circumstances, it's a little different. Never have seen that before, so we will see.
The last week of Ramadan starts this Sunday, and Bilal doesn't have much time to make sure people in the Muslim community will have access to food. For Wyoming Public Radio News, I'm Naina Rao.
Over the past 2 years, the Fort Washakie School has revived a tradition called the Five Buffalo Days, a week-long celebration of the cultural and ecological significance of buffalo for Plains Native people. This year's celebration had to be moved online, but tribal educators say During this pandemic, the lessons students learn during the Five Buffalo Days are more important than ever. Wyoming Public Radio's Savannah Marr spoke with one of those educators.
The Five Buffalo Days are all about helping students know themselves better, where they come from, and what their role is in the community. But for the better part of the last 10 years, the event took a hiatus. When Lynette St. Clair took a job as the Indian Education Coordinator at Fort Washakie School, she felt her students were missing out.
It was, I thought, important for them to understand the connection that we have as Indian people to the buffalo. Because for many reasons, we are still here because of the buffalo.
So last year, she brought the Five Buffalo Days back. When we spoke last summer, she told me it started in the science classrooms.
The teachers teach them about the several different uses of the buffalo parts. They teach them about like the geographical, you know, the migratory patterns of the buffalo.
Then grandmas and grandpas started coming into the school to teach the kids stories about the buffalo, how to tell them in Shoshone, and how to use different parts of the animal in ceremony. Last year's revamped Five Buffalo Days came with some modifications. Instead of a Friday parade all around Fort Washakie, students rode on horseback and in floats around the school building. And unlike the old days, they didn't get to harvest a real buffalo. But last year's celebration was supposed to be special in a different way. It coincided with a gift of five buffalo from the Fort Peck tribes in northeast Montana to the eastern Shoshone tribe.
We were like super excited that it was so, it was like poetry in motion, how it was happening at the inception of our return of the Five Buffalo Days here at Fort Washakie School.
But it didn't quite work out that way. Bad weather in Montana meant that the buffalo couldn't be rounded up, so their trip to Wind River was postponed.
We were really bummed that it didn't happen. You know, of course, it was a reminder by, you know, I think the powers that be that we're not in control of everything. And so for me, it was like a strong reminder that you have to adapt and change to accommodate the times and the circumstance.
And of course, this year, Fort Washakie school students are learning that lesson all over again.
You know, since COVID-19, we had to recalibrate and figure out how we were going to bring the Five Buffalo Days to our students, you know, through a virtual aspect.
I spoke with St. Clair again on Wednesday of this week, day three of the virtual Five Buffalo Days. In some ways, this is a pared-down version, but she says that during the pandemic, it's even more important that Fort Washakie school students understand Shoshone and Arapaho history.
You know, for Indian people, I mean, of course it affects us. It affects us in a huge way. But, you know, these are things that we have contended with since the reservation system. You know, these are storms that we ride out, but we do it together.
And that they understand Shoshone and Arapaho values.
And I was telling my daughter this last night. I said, you know, there's never been a time that I've been more proud of where I come from because, you know, when this first started, how everybody was going out and buying all the stuff up, you know. And it was like, what the heck, you know, people are thinking more about themselves rather than about everybody else. It's about me, me, me. And it's not, geez, I better help my family or take care of my elders. But, you know, here on the res, we were just kind of going, well, what's with all the toilet paper, for real? And so taking care of each other is something that we have always done as Indian people, and so that's something that we continue to do.
St. Clair says there's one event that they won't be able to move online. Because of that gift of five buffalo last spring, the Shoshone tribe's herd had a few buffalo to spare this year.
Our kids were really excited to have the opportunity to actually see a buffalo being harvested and learn more about the process.
And while they didn't get to watch the harvest, many Fort Washakie school students got to eat some of the buffalo meat, which was donated to Eastern Shoshone and Northern Arapaho tribal members in need. The harvested buffalo have been replaced by two new calves born into the herd this spring, and the tribe is expecting more. St. Clair hopes that means there'll be buffalo to spare next year, too, and her students will get to experience a harvest. Either way, she says next year's Five Buffalo Days will be one to remember.
Yes, it will be. A huge celebration. I think the community will be ready for that. I know I'll be.
For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Savannah Marr on the Wind River Reservation.
When we return, a look at an, very unusual approach to monitoring whether the coronavirus is spiking in your community. And a conversation with an LGBTQ artist and activist from Wyoming. Stick around for lots more on Open Spaces. Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. I'm Melody Edwards. State parks are opening this weekend to Wyoming residents only. To ensure that this is the case, the Department of Outdoor Recreation and State Parks has instituted a reservation process that's only opened to Wyoming residents. Deputy Director Dave Glenn discusses the plan with Wyoming Public Radio's Bob Beck.
So the thing that I guess has caught everybody's attention is in the past, certainly there were some sites you had to make reservations for, but the way this is going to change is that all of us, for the most part, are going to have to make reservations if we want to camp in these facilities. Could you talk a little bit about that and how this will work?
Sure. So traditionally, about 40% of our campgrounds have been available by reservation. And with the COVID-19 situation, we wanted to be able to control who was coming to our state and going camping. So by going to the reservation system, it allows us to get Wyoming nights out camping as soon as we could, which was one of our number one goals. But it allows us to easily more exclude out-of-state campers as well. There's some other advantages. We reduce dangers associated with cache handling. Since we're doing less cache handling, some of our seasonal staff will be out in the field maintaining, mowing, cleaning toilets, doing those types of things. And it allows us to limit some site availability of those campsites that are extremely close to each other for social distancing reasons.
Yeah, I wanted to ask you about that. I know there's some even here just outside of Laramie where a lot of clusters are. How will that be handled? Will you just maybe put a couple of folks up in those areas? How will that work?
Yeah, so our group shelters will remain closed. Our group camping areas will allow one camper at. And then we've gone through site by site and looked at them and said, are these far enough to meet the social distancing guidelines? If they're far enough apart, they'll both be available. Some of those are right on top of each other. We'll probably shut down every other one. And that allows us to do that going through the reservation system.
The whole reason, as you suggested, we wanted to is to keep the people from out of state. What was the problem? Is there was the thought that there'd be just so many?
Yes, and there was already, even in March, starting to be a huge influx. So we're monitoring that closely. As other states start to open up their camping, we'll probably look at reaching out to the state health officer and the governor's office to expand camping to non-residents. And we also understand that that's an economic driver for some of our communities, such as Park County, with folks heading into Yellowstone, or Platte County, Glendo and Guernsey. So we're going to work on that, but we're going to watch it really closely, and we'll make that decision at the right time.
Dave Glenn visiting with us. Again, Dave, I told you before we started that, I'm aware that there's a petition out there of some folks from Wyoming very concerned about this. I wouldn't be surprised if a couple of my staff members are on that. So let me ask you about this decision, because for a lot of folks, it's, oh, wow, it's Friday night. Let's go out and camp. Let's do this for the weekend. It's not like a long thought out process. There's a lot of people concerned about that you're taking away some of their freedoms, of course. Tell me why this won't mess with their lives.
Well, and I'll tell you this, Bob, my wife and I are exactly like some of those people that are concerned. It's usually after a long week on a Friday, we come home from work and she says, let's go camping. And we throw our gear and our boats in the vehicle and head out to the state park. Folks will still be able to do that. There's several different options. You can get online and reserve a spot before you go. You can reserve a spot on your drive there through the application or doing it through online. Or if you want to go do the traditional hunt and peck where you go to the campground and find the spot you like, if it's empty, you call the reservation company, you get online, see if it's available. If it's available, you reserve it right then and there and pull in and go camping.
You don't think this will impact too many people and keep them from the opportunity to camp on the weekend?
Oh, no, I think it will actually be easier for folks once they get used to the system. I know from my perspective, we spend a lot of time driving around trying to find a campsite. Sure be nice to know which campsite I'm going to before I get there.
Now, the other thing I'm hearing about, Dave, is this fee to reserve a campsite. Is it $7.50 to do this every time?
$7.75, and that's not per night. That's per reservation. And we're working right now with the reservation company. That price is going to go down for residents. It's going to take a while, but we're negotiating with them right now. And frankly, it'll probably go up for non-residents. So stay tuned in the next coming few months, because those prices will drop down.
The other thing I was curious about, just for our friends from Colorado, Montana, and other places, is this, I have been told over the years that it wasn't legal to keep people from other states from coming in and using our places. Was I misled, or is this a special circumstance?
You know, it's a good question, and it is a special circumstance. And people can still come from out of state and go camping on federal lands in Wyoming right now. It's just the state parks that we're keeping closed until we feel that it's the right time, due to the COVID-19 situation, to start bringing a lot of non-residents to our campgrounds.
Okay, Dave Glenn, a pleasure. Thank you so much for joining us.
Bob, thank you very much.
It's not just state parks considering the safest way to welcome tourists. As national parks prepare to open up, everyone is trying to figure out new and more inventive ways to track the virus. Gateway communities have come up with a truly unique approach, testing their community's poop. Wyoming Public Radio's Camila Kudelska explains.
Cody has anxiously been waiting for Yellowstone National Park to open up since its economy depends on summer tourism. Mayor Matt Hall says the community is willing to try new ideas.
We kind of have to take probably a little bit of a risk to open. I mean, until we have a vaccine and stuff, that's the only sure thing. The virus is probably going to be a way of life for quite a while until then. So I think people are, you know, they're ready.
Hall says restaurants, law enforcement, and public health officials are all working together to prepare for any potential medical surge. He says this includes hiring extra people for contact tracing.
So when we probably get some virus that shows up, we can try and do our best to contain it, to see who's interacted with those people or whoever has it, and really try and do everything you can proactively to keep it from spreading.
Because as Hall and other public officials are aware, an influx of people coming into the community will probably increase the presence of coronavirus in the community. So in order to try to create a balance, they are surveying one more thing.
If you can measure the concentration of the virus that's present in the wastewater, and you have some data on how much virus an infected individual excretes, you can then maybe estimate how many people are excreting that virus.
That's Kyle Bibby. He's a University of Notre Dame environmental engineering professor. He says as COVID-19 continued to spread, they realized they could probably detect the virus in human waste as well and determine whether an entire community sees a spike in cases. This is not a new idea.
There's been surveillance type efforts for viruses, most notably poliovirus, for decades.
So the way it works, after the eagle has landed in the morning and you flush the toilet, human waste travels through the plumbing system of your community and eventually ends up at the wastewater treatment plant. This is when a city wastewater operator can test whether the wastewater has the virus in it. Today, the operator opens an access hatch and pours some of the wastewater into a bucket. Then he places a long stick in the bucket, which collects the sample. Cody Public Works Director Philip Bowman says the city is collecting samples like this every hour for one day, and then that gets sent to the lab.
That collection over a 24-hour period is viewed to be representative of what the community waste stream is over a one-day period.
Jackson is also testing its community's poop. Teton County Health Officer Dr. Travis Riddell says the results, if done in regular intervals, can give you a baseline of presence of the virus in the community.
The idea is that if you're seeing increased amounts of the virus in your wastewater, it may be an early indication that there are increasing cases in the community.
About 330 wastewater facilities in 40 states are using this method, but it's especially helpful for these gateway communities because of the impending influx of tourists. But Riddell and other gateway community health officers say the data from the wastewater can't be the only data point they use to take any action. It's more of a baseline to compare and contrast.
If we saw a clear trend of decreasing viral copies in the wastewater, and then suddenly we saw that trend reverse and the numbers spike up again, that would be an indicator that it would be a good idea to take some sort of action.
Jackson has already completed two tests, and Riddell says the results look promising, but he wants more data points before he puts any real value in it. And that's the plan. Jackson is testing its wastewater every week, and while Cody hasn't gotten its first test results back yet, Parr County Health Officer Dr. Aaron Billen says the plan is to test at regular intervals as well.
If it comes back and says there are 5 people in your community shed virus at your baseline, we know where we start. But once the park opens and the hotels fill up, if we now have 150 people shedding virus, then we know we have a problem.
Even though the 3 Montana Yellowstone gates haven't opened yet, those gateway communities are also planning or are already testing its wastewater system.
We're dependent on tourism. It's our part to help the park manage the return of tourists.
It might seem crazy, but monitoring the town's poop might just be the best way to keep a handle on the presence of the virus. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Camila Kadalska at the Center of the West in Cody.
Now, look at Wyoming's arts. Andrew Munns is an LGBTQ activist and performing artist based out of Jackson. Being gay in Wyoming can be challenging, but Munns has decided to stay and try to make things better. Wyoming Public Radio's Megan Feary spoke to him about art, activism, and growing up in the cowboy state.
I did not grow up on a ranch. A lot of other people in Wyoming will look at me as somebody who grew up in Jackson and kind of roll their eyes. And in Jackson, there's this sense of wealth, and I just did not have that upbringing. My family was very middle class. I couldn't afford to go skiing all the time. I couldn't afford the season pass. There's a lot of things that kind of come with the idea of Jackson life that I really had no part of.
So you never felt like you really fit in?
I grew up gay, and you know, I was living in the closet up until I was 21, and I did have this fear and thought that I did not necessarily belong to the Wyoming lifestyle of hypermasculinity and grit. That wasn't really who I was, and so trying to find your footing in a place like Wyoming was difficult for me. I found ways to express myself.
And that was through acting and comedy. What did those outlets do for you?
Being up on stage and pretending to be somebody that I wasn't offered me this chance of escaping the fear that I had growing up. So I found that joy in performance, and I haven't stopped. Finding ways to express myself has been the only reason I'm still around, I think. And if I didn't have those creative outlets, I feel like I would be in a much worse place.
Do you consider yourself an activist?
I do, but it's also an exhausting endeavor to be an activist. Last year at the Old West Days Parade, I entered the LGBTQ community as an entry in Jackson's longest running parade. And I marched down Broadway with a massive rainbow pride flag and a cowboy hat. And no one asked me to do it, but we did it anyway. And some people's expressions were downturned. Other people were applauding and hollering for us. It's those small little things that you can do. And, you know, it can't always be full legislation change. In a small town, you know, sometimes like a small act can resonate with people. And that's been the most honest and meaningful outcome of what I've been able to participate in.
Wyoming doesn't have a good reputation or history when it comes to advocating for or protecting the LGBTQ community. How has this affected you?
When I think about Wyoming's legacy, for a lot of people, it kind of boils down to two things campgrounds, and that's Matthew Shepard and Brokeback Mountain, one of which is this terrible murder. Another kind of has been reduced to a joke. From my journey, Matthew Shepard's death occurred when I was 11, and I remember every fence post I saw was a crime scene. Because once you have that fear, it doesn't necessarily go away. It doesn't just vanish. You know, ultimately, it's trauma that you carry. And for myself, I feel good that I was able to at least close the book on this thing that I'd been carrying with me a little bit. And now I'm kind of like moving on to laughter and joy. And that's the trajectory that I'm putting myself on.
And where do you think Wyoming stands now in terms of LGBTQ acceptance?
When I was marching down the street for Old West Days, you know, I got some pretty awful messages from anonymous Facebook accounts. And that stuff was discouraging, but I didn't want to share those words because I feel like the more power I gave those voices, the less power I was giving myself. Do I think that there's still homophobia in the state? 100%. Do I still think it's in my community? Absolutely. Like, that's not something that's easily changeable. You know, people's perceptions and people's beliefs are not the most malleable things. And so the more we can showcase to more conservative minds that LGBTQ culture is not all about sex. It's about expression. It's about fun and acceptance and laughter and parody. And there's a lot of elements that, unfortunately, a more bigoted mindset tends to blot out when it comes to the reality of LGBTQ culture.
So what do you think the future might look like for Wyoming?
Do I think everything's going to be fine one day and, you know, we're never going to have this discussion again? I don't. I think people will always be different. People will always hold on to their more traditional beliefs, and you can't really fault them for that. You can fault people for committing crimes, for harming other people, but ultimately, to be mad at somebody for the way that they believe, it's a difficult pill to swallow sometimes, but you have to move on and you have to affect change where you're able to. Unfortunately, Wyoming is just one of those places where it takes a little bit longer.
Andrew Munns, I want to thank you so much for speaking with me.
Thank you so much.
Next up, how hospitals are getting financially hit by the pandemic. And a look at the bright side to living during these crazy times. This is Open Spaces. Welcome back to Open Spaces. I'm Melody Edwards. The United States is seeing its highest unemployment levels since the Great Depression, and nurses, doctors, and other healthcare workers are not immune to pay cuts and furloughs. The Mountain West News Bureau's Noah Glick reports on what that means here.
Jody Dominic is a registered nurse at Sunrise Hospital in Las Vegas, Nevada.
We come in, we fight the anxiety and the fear. We know the risks. We've seen them firsthand, what happens when you get sick with this horrible virus, and we show up.
But she says fewer staff are showing up to work these days.
There have been reduced hours, and with the cut of the elective surgeries, there are a lot of people not working who would normally be working.
That might seem strange at first, that medical staff, the frontline workers amid this pandemic, would be vulnerable to job cuts or furloughs.
Hospital finances are very complex.
That's Michelle Hood. She's been a hospital administrator for 40 years. She's now the executive vice president of the American Hospital Association.
Typically, our hospitals in this country run very thin margins.
Financial gains from elective procedures like hip replacements offset the losses from things like ER visits. But with the pandemic, those hip replacements? Not happening.
And as a result, their revenue has dropped significantly.
Her organization estimates that between March and June, American hospitals and health systems will lose more than $202 billion. She says it's too early to tell whether the federal funds for hospitals and the stimulus package will go far enough. So to compensate, Hood says hospitals are now looking to cut expenses, And the biggest line item, people.
In very efficient hospitals, there are approximately 50% of the total expenses. In some specialty hospitals like psychiatry and so forth, they can be 75 to 80% of the total expenses.
Hence, furloughs and reduced hours for medical staff. Matthew Walker says rural hospitals are particularly fragile from a financial standpoint. He runs the hospital and health clinic in rural Ely, Nevada. He says COVID-19 hasn't hit their community hard yet, but they're prepared.
So from a health standpoint, everything is really quite good.
The hospital's finances, not so much. Even with federal stimulus money, Walker says his system could lose about $1 million this year. But furloughs aren't an option.
We actually have to figure out what to do with our docs, because if we just tell them, hey, we don't have work for you, there's the possibility that they say, well, then I'm just not going to come back to Ely, you know, and then that would hurt us from a long-term standpoint.
Walker says his hospital is the only one in more than 200 miles, and that on average, it takes about a year, year and a half to recruit a new physician. The facility is also short on nurses.
But, you know, if we end up getting more cases here, and then all of a sudden some of our nurses leave, or even if our nurses get sick, it's not like we can just pull someone in.
Still, at least one hospital bond analyst is optimistic.
When the dust settles, we're going to look and ultimately have a stronger healthcare system in the U.S.
Kevin Hollerin is with Fitch Analytics and heads up the firm's hospital and healthcare group. He says the pandemic has essentially put all Americans on a pilot program that's trying new ways to deliver healthcare. He says the emerging innovation offers a path forward. Take the increased adoption of telemedicine right now.
You can measure breath capacity for people that might have asthma to hook up to your smartphone and these wearable devices. All of these things are going to expand. Don't go back to making people drive downtown to the big hospital to get those tests done.
Hollerin says there's still a lot left to be discussed. And of course, any changes will need the cooperation of the health insurance industry. But he expects the pandemic to change the way people think about healthcare delivery. That means more conversations around a single-payer system, or more mergers and acquisitions in the sector, or maybe even increased Medicare and Medicaid payments.
I'm one of those people that think this pandemic, this COVID crisis, will open up a lot of people's eyes to say, you know, not only did I not really appreciate, you know, how valuable it was to have a good, strong, well-performing hospital down the street, you know, I realize that I, meaning society, need to figure out a way to make sure it stays that way if I don't enhance it.
Making sure hospitals and their staff are safe and financially healthy will be the ultimate challenge as the country and the industry navigates into an uncertain post-pandemic reality. For the Mountain West News Bureau, I'm Noah Glick.
The news can tend to focus on everything that's going wrong. So Wyoming Public Radio's Aaron Jones wanted to know about Wyomingites' pandemic silver linings. Here are some of the messages that you left.
My name is Mark. I live in Jackson. My wife is staying at home right now, working from home, all by herself. So we went and got 2 7-year-old kittens, and they totally entertain her and make her laugh all day long. Okay.
Hi, my name's Tate Smith.
Hi, this is Phil Sundstrom. I'm in Newcastle.
I think one of the awesome silver linings is the amount of virtual meetings that are happening has significantly increased public access to public meetings and governmental goings-on.
During this time, I've been blessed to see my adult son at least 5 times a week. He is a pastor at a Wesleyan church about 400 miles away, but all the streaming of church services, Bible studies, devotionals these days means that I connect with him online every day or two, and that is a real blessing in the midst of everything.
As well as attending other events around the state and around the country that have gone virtual, you get to attend things that you wouldn't have been able to attend to otherwise.
My name is Jane Lynn. I live in Lander, Wyoming, and my pandemic silver lining is that I've never known how to use my telephone ever, my smartphone. Like, I use it to dial and I text barely. But during this pandemic, my friends have been sending me really cute, cheerful YouTube videos, and I have been forced to learn how to use my phone, to sit down and actually concentrate and figure out how to use my phone. And I know all you youngsters are laughing at me right now, but there are still dinosaurs out there who don't know how to use our phones.
My name is Christy. I live in Laramie, and one silver lining I have
is I'm a teacher and I have learned how to use a new online platform to teach my students, so I've enjoyed learning that new skill.
Yes, my name is Henry Holdsworth. I'm in Jackson, Wyoming, and I am a wildlife photographer and have a gallery downtown, which is closed due to the pandemic, so I'm spending more time at home. And after the parks were closed for a while, kind of getting an itchy trigger finger, wanting something to photograph, and I was fortunate enough to be home and have a moose with two yearling calves spend most of our shutdown with us. So they hung out in my yard, my neighbor's yard, and around the neighborhood for the last 6 weeks and gave me something to photograph, which I might not have seen if I wasn't home during the day.
I think for anybody in Wyoming, it's a lot of us that have introvert tendencies. This is great. We don't have to make up reasons why we can't go out and do something. We can just not do it. So it's fabulous. We can play in the garden and we can go hike by ourselves or walk the ditch roads and just be really, really happy. So that's my 2 cents worth. Okay, bye.
That's my silver lining. Thanks.
Have a good one. Thank you. Bye.
Thanks so much. Great idea to do this. Bye-bye.
Hope you're all doing well. Thank you. Bye-bye.
Those were the voices of Wyomingites on their pandemic silver linings. Aaron Jones produced the piece. We're so glad that you could join us for this episode of Open Spaces. We wanted to share some very exciting news that we got this week. Wyoming Public Radio received 6 regional Edward R. Murrow Awards for stories that you've heard this year on this show or on our podcast, The Modern West. That's a new record for us, and we hope you'll support us with a contribution so that we can keep winning awards like this well into the future, especially since we didn't get to hold our spring fun drive. It's easy to do. Just visit us at wyomingpublicmedia.org and click on the donate button. Anna Rader is our web editor. Open Spaces is a production of Wyoming Public Radio News.